evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, October 30th, 2017. Cattle keepers from Jonglei say they want to return home, but they are afraid.
I can be able to leave, but the issue now, it is still raining and the grass is tall now. It would be better for me to leave in December or in January when the grass is burned. So we beg the government, for the case of our children, we need to be given some time.
And a disarmament program continues to face challenges in South Sudan.
The hardest part is dealing with the expectations of the people around the world who are, especially in conflict zones, who expect change to occur immediately when we work to make it difficult for arms to go to conflict zones.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Cattle keepers from Jonglei State who are settled in Equatorial Region are under pressure to return by authorities. The farmers in Equatorial have complained repeatedly about cattle destroying their crops, which sometimes led to violent clashes between the two groups. Manyang David Mayer reports for VOA from Juba.
President Salva Kiir's latest decree on cattle keepers was read out on state television last Wednesday, ordering cattle keepers to move their cattle out of Equatoria immediately or risk being forced out by soldiers. The president's early announcements asked the pastoralists to return to their homes. More than a year later, it has yet to be enforced. Both community leaders met with representatives of the cattle keepers in Juba over the weekend to discuss how to implement the president's latest decree. This time, Boer community leaders are telling cattle keepers they must move their cattle back to their original villages and do it promptly. Professor Ajoy Magot is chairperson of Dinka Boer community in Juba.
We deliberated and unanimously we said the president's order must be implemented with immediate effect as it was put in the order. And these cattle camp leaders who came, they were to convey the same message to those who could not attend.
Speaking in Dinka, Makeny Majuk, who leads the Dinka Boer cattle keepers in Equatoria, requested more time for cattle keepers to leave the area.
I can be able to leave, but the issue now, it is still raining and the grass is tall now. It would be better for me to leave in December or in January, when the grass is burned. So we beg the government, for the case of our children, we need to be given some time, and thereafter, we will be able to leave.
But Ajoy says cattle keepers have had plenty of time to relocate to Jonglei and have failed to do so.
There will be no good time for you, because this is not the first time. The first time when the president gave the order, you did not implement it. So whether the grass is tall now or not, we will not accept that. So you must just have to move.
Majuk says cattle keepers like himself are ready to break down the cattle camps and moved out of Equatoria, but worry about insecurity on their way back to Jonglei State.
I have accepted to move. But for my departure, I put my safety into your hands as the government so that there will be nobody to attack me on the way. I am on the move by your orders. You speak with your communities along the way. I am with my children and my cows. I trust that nobody will attack me on the way because you told me to move.
Dinka Boer community leader Magot says he and other leaders will speak with Jubek and Terkeka state authorities to ensure the safe return of the cattle keepers on their way home. For VOA News, I'm Manyang David Mayar in Juba.
South Sudan's media authority has suspended two media associations because they have failed to register with the authority. AMDIS, which is the Association for Media Development in South Sudan, and the Union of Journalists of South Sudan were suspended last week. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Juba.
The Union of Journalists of South Sudan and the Association for Media Development in South Sudan were suspended on Friday for allegedly operating illegally. The media authority says the two organizations must register at its office and obtain operational certificates. AMDI's head, Mary Ajit, says she was surprised to receive a letter from the media authority suspending its operation. She says the media authority's decision contradicts the law. Ajit says the media authority has given her association only 1 week to register their activities or be closed down completely. Aside from not having enough time to respond, she says the decision contradicts resolution passed in the recent media workshop in which lawmakers, the media authority, and the suspended associations all participated.
This came as a surprise for us because it was just on the 20th of this month when we had a high-level meeting which involved even the members of parliament, which involved judges from the Supreme Court, and some prominent lawyers were there and other stakeholders. So in that meeting, it was agreed during the workshop that the registration of any institution should be upheld. Meanwhile, the registration should continue, and that we should dialogue among ourselves.
Ajit says AMDIS is already a legal entity operating in the country since 2006 after it was legally registered with Relief and Rehabilitation Commission. She says she and her colleagues wonder why AMDIS must register again. In any event, she says the AMDIS Board of Trustees has agreed to register again so that it can continue to carry out the association's activities.
We have resolved to test and see whether whatever operation license that will be given to us will contradict our activities and our objectives or not. So we have decided to apply for the registration with Media Authority because you cannot judge a book according to its cover.
Ajit says there is a great need in a country like South Sudan for media associations to educate the population on the media laws. She says it is better for them to try to work with the media authority rather than confront it so they can continue their work.
Going to court would be like, yes, that is what the law says, but in our environment it would just be like confrontation. And there will be no more education of our people on what the media does.
Officials from Union of Journalists of South Sudan declined to comment on the association's suspension, saying since being suspended, they do not have a legal basis on which to speak to the media. Ajit says AMDIS will continue to advocate for press freedom in South Sudan in accordance with the provisions of law.
We still have our objective. We also still have the provision in the Media Act that the journalists have the right to form their associations without any interference.
The Media Authority's Managing Director, Alija Alier, confirmed his organization suspended the two media associations late last week, but declined to comment any further. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
The UN Office for Disarmament Affairs works to reduce landmines and small arms and other conventional weapons around the world. The office recently gathered civil society members in New York to discuss ways to better achieve that mission. A member of the South Sudan Action Network on Small Arms, Duke Godfrey, tells Ayen Bior that civil society organizations play an important role in ensuring that illicit arms, which could be used to violate human rights, do not enter conflict zones.
I've been invited by the UN Office of Disarmament Affairs and the Small Arms Survey to join a group of experts also from different parts of the world to explore the nexus between small arms control instruments and the Sustainable Development Goals, with a specific focus on Goal 16, which is advancing peace and justice. Part of the global community of civil society organizations working on humanitarian disarmament. And, of course, this group of civil society organizations have been working closely with both governments and the UN in trying to advance arms control instruments.
What would you say is the hardest part of your job?
Well, the hardest part is, I think, dealing with expectations of the people around the world who are in especially in conflict zones, who expect change to occur immediately when we work to make it difficult for arms to go to conflict zones. But unfortunately, that is also my wish, that if we put in place an arms control mechanism, for example, to stop arms from going to conflict zones for use for human rights abuses and violation of international humanitarian law, that when we put frameworks in place, that the impact is experienced immediately. Unfortunately, it takes years before such instruments become effective. For example, the Arms Trade Treaty, adopted in 2013, up to now, appears to be ineffective in terms of curbing arms flows to a country such as South Sudan and Saudi Arabia and Yemen.
Why is that? Why is it so hard, would you say?
Using the Arms Trade Treaty as an example, it requires that states who are state parties or signatories use a risk assessment mechanism that is a part of the treaty to put every country that they are considering arms transfer to under a risk assessment, to see if these arms are going to be used to violate human rights, to be used in gender-based violence and stuff related to rape and generally in violation of human rights and international humanitarian law. Now, the biggest problem here is that these provisions apply to only state parties. So states have to be parties to the Arms Trade Treaty to adopt these measures of risk assessment, and if there is risk, stop transfers.
That was Geoffrey Duque, a member of the South Sudan Action Network on Small Arms. He was speaking to Ian Bior from our studios in Washington. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at what it takes to get a work permit in South Sudan. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are you satisfied with the schooling your children are getting?
I will say I'm not satisfied because the government schools are not well acquainted with what they're doing. The teachers don't turn up. I know that maybe in private schools, the fees are so high.
Yes, I am satisfied with the schooling because as an African child, the schools here in Africa, I see that they teach children a lot, mostly in the boarding schools. They teach them how to wash, how to take care of themselves while they're young.
Kind of satisfied because I will see that the schools that the children are in are teaching them the basics that they really need in life. And it's not only about majorly the educational aspect of it, but there are also other co-curriculum activities that they're getting involved in.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan government has issued a new circular reducing the amount the government is charging for a work permit for foreign workers. In March, the government announced it would increase work permit fees for white-collar jobs from $500 to $10,000 per year. The government also said work permits for casual workers would be increased to $1,000 from $100 a year. The government has since suspended implementation of that order, largely due to an outcry from aid agencies and foreign embassies in Juba. According to the latest circular issued by Mary Hillary, Undersecretary at the Ministry of Labour, Public Service and Humanitarian and Human Resources, managers and consultants will have to pay $4,000 a year for work permit. Those in white-collar jobs preferred to be in secular professionals such as doctors and lawyers, are required to pay $3,000 per year rather than the previously stated $10,000. In addition, the secular says technicians will pay $2,000 for a work permit for a year, while skilled workers will pay $1,000. And skilled workers such as cleaners will pay $500, which is down from $1,000. The secular also indicates that foreign employees must pay a fine of $200. It's not clear under what circumstances such fines would be charged. Undersecretary Mary did not comment on the new directive, saying she was busy and would comment later. Officials at the South Sudan NGO Forum, which coordinates the activities of international and national aid agencies operating in the country, declined to comment on the reduction in work permit fees, saying they are still consulting with their counterparts. The secular says the new work permit fees will go into effect on November 1st. The report was prepared by Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba. Kenya's incumbent president, Uhuru Kenyatta, has won last week's election, which the opposition boycotted with just 98% of the vote, according to Kenya's Electoral Commission. Wafula Chabukati, the head of the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, says turnout for Thursday's poll was just under 39% of the 19.6 million registered voters. Opposition leader Raila Odinga, who dropped out of the race, called on supporters to boycott the vote. But protesters blocked polling stations from opening in some opposition stronghold. Our colleague Vincent Macori is in Nairobi and talks about the latest development with VOA's Kim Lewis.
The big announcement today is the IBC are formally declaring Uhuru Kenyatta the duly elected president of the Republic of Kenya. This follows, of course, the process that has termed as sham by the opposition. Mr. Raila Odinga, the main opposition leader, of course, withdrew from this election, but the process went ahead. And they said Mr. Uhuru Kenyatta has garnered enough votes to be declared the president of this country.
Also, I understand that there were some areas in the western regions that were not able to vote or the voting has been delayed. What is the status on that?
In fact, there are about 25 areas where the election has not taken place. There was postponement earlier. They were to happen on Saturday, last Saturday. Then they postponed and said that will happen at a later date. It doesn't look like the elections will take place in that place. Now, questions are whether that will render the whole process illegitimate. But then the argument is that the Jubilee Coalition candidate, President Uhuru Kenyatta, has enough votes from the constitutionally mandated regions to qualify as a president. And therefore, it may not really matter that there won't be elections in those 25 areas. Well, that again leaves, I think, place for further discussion as to whether that might be an issue as far as voting rules and the Constitution is concerned, where apparently there is a place where it says that every region has to participate in the process in order for it to be considered a legitimate election.
What impact has this rerun election had on the country? Is it more divided now than it was before?
In fact, for the first time, I think Kenyans are realizing how divided this country is, how divided it is along ethnic lines especially. And so at the moment, there is a lot of discussion as to how to move forward this country, what to do in order to bring all people together under a system that will guarantee that everybody can feel as part of this nation, because there are some millions of people right now who feel like the current government that may continue to rule is in fact perhaps representing two or three ethnic communities and the others feel left behind. And that has generated a lot of debate. There are so many questions being raised as to how will the president, when he becomes officially inaugurated, if that happens, how will he bring the country together so that many can feel that they're part of this country. In fact, there have been all sorts of talks, including some counties, some states, considering even secession. The talk of secession has come up. That's how serious things are, where some regions are feeling like that. Perhaps time has come for them to think of self-rule.
Also, there has been accusations of acts of political violence and intimidation by both sides. For instance, the human rights organization Amnesty International is saying that even police brutality has taken place. Do you hear a lot of that going on?
So many people have been shot dead by the police. There's no way of avoiding that. It has been a reality, a very painful reality, that dozens of people have been killed up to this point across the country, starting from August until today. There have been cases of groups of protesters turning violent in some places. In so many situations, there have been accusations of the police using unnecessary force against peaceful protesters, and therefore leading to not only death, but so many people being maimed, and so many hospitals have right now tending to so many protesters who have been taken in with different forms of injuries. There are tensions still in other parts of the country where certain communities are, in fact, have engaged in confrontations. And again, all this occasioned by this rerun election.
That was our colleague Vincent Macori speaking with VOA's Kim Louise earlier today from Nairobi. West and Central Africa have the highest prevalence rates of child marriage on the continent and the second highest in the world behind South Asia. Reversing this trend could have a major economic benefits. That's according to experts taking part in a high-level meetings in Senegal recently aimed at reviving the campaign to end child marriage in the region. Sophia Christensen reports from Dakar.
Khadifai was 11 when her mother told her she would soon be getting married.
On a fait une fête, mais moi, je ne suis pas là-bas. On a fait des beignets, tous, moi, je suis partie dans un...
She says there was a party, but I didn't go. Everyone made beignets, but I went into the forest and cried. I stayed there until dark. Fai soon found out she was pregnant. Her family supported her decision to divorce her husband and took in her son when he was born. But her life had been upended.
Mon petite sœur, elle est partie pour faire le CD.
She says after her divorce, she felt too old to go back to school. She didn't want to be in the same class as her little sister, so she stayed home to help her mother. She would eventually leave her village in the Fatick region of southwest Senegal and end up on the streets. VOA met Khadi at the Maison Rose, a shelter for girls and women on the outskirts of Dakar. She is now 23 years old with limited prospects. Experts gathered in Dakar are taking aim at the economic impact of child marriage. West and Central Africa is home to 6 of the 10 countries with the highest prevalence rates worldwide. According to UNICEF, 4 in 10 girls in the region are married before the age of 18. In a new study, the World Bank says that by 2030, the annual benefit from ending child marriage could reach well above $60 billion for West and Central Africa. Quentin Wadon is a lead economist for the World Bank.
When they marry as children, before the age of 18, they tend to have more children over the lifetime and also children earlier. So that reduction in fertility has an impact on population growth. And what happens is that if you reduce population growth, then GDP per capita would increase.
The World Bank estimates that by 2030, governments would also see a benefit of $5 billion annually due to reduced under-5 mortality and stunting, both seen as related to early childbearing. The study also looked at the current earning potential of women like Hadi, who were child brides. In the 6 countries that account for 2/3 of the region's population, the World Bank found that women married as girls have lost out on over $8 billion in income, and that amount is likely to rise if trends continue. But economic conditions in the region also help keep the practice alive, says Mabel Van Oranje, the chair of Girls Not Brides, a global partnership working to end child marriage.
I think it has to do partially with the enormous levels of poverty here. It also has to do a lot with social norms, tradition. You know, it's an honorable thing to make sure that your daughter is married at a young age and parents think that they do the right thing.
She adds that so far, only 4 West and Central African countries have developed national strategies to end child marriage: Nigeria, Burkina Faso, Ghana, and Chad. The World Bank hopes that highlighting the economic impacts of child marriage could push African governments to act. Hadiza Amino is a technical advisor to Nigeria's vice president.
Findings will help us in terms of advocating for funding from the legislative sector so that we get money allocated to these areas.
Last year, Nigeria implemented a plan to end child marriage by 2021. But the country is still predicted to have the continent's highest number of child brides by 2050. At current rates of progress, The UN Children's Fund says it will take over 100 years to eradicate child marriage from West and Central Africa. UNICEF say getting girls to school and keeping them there as long as possible is one of the best strategies for reversing the trend. Sophia Christensen for VOA News, Dakar.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Cattle keepers from Jungle Estate who are grazing their cattle in parts of Equatoria are being told by authorities to return to their home villages. Farmers in the Equatoria region have complained time and again about cattle destroying their crops and property. Skirmishes between pastoralists and villagers has led to violence in the past. The latest presidential decree ordering cattle keepers to leave Equatoria was broadcast on state television last week. It said if they don't leave voluntarily, the cattle keepers will be forced out by soldiers. President Kiir told the cattle keepers to leave more than a year ago, but that order has never been enforced. Boer community leaders met with cattle keeper representatives in Juba over the weekend to talk about how to implement the president's latest decree. Professor Ajoy Magat, chairperson of the Dinka Boer community in Juba, says Mr. Kiir's order must be implemented promptly. Makech Majok, head of the Dinka Boer cattle keepers in Equatoria, asked that they be given more time to leave the area. South Sudan's media authority has suspended two media associations for failing to register with the authority. The Union of Journalists in South Sudan and the Association for Media Development in South Sudan, or AMDIS, were suspended on Friday. The head of the media authority says the two groups must register at its offices and obtain operational certificates. AMDIS head Mary Ajith says she was supposed to get a letter from the media authority suspending its operations, but she says that letter contradicts the law. She says the association worked out a deal with the authority, at least she thought so, at a recent workshop and had registered years ago. Ajith says the authority has given her group only 1 week to register their activities or be closed down completely. And finally, the government issued a new circular reducing the fees for work permits to foreign workers. In March, the government said it would increase work permit fees for white-collar jobs from $500 to $10,000 per year, and fees for casual workers would rise from $100 to $1,000 a year. After a widespread outcry from aid agencies and foreign embassies in Juba, the government suspended that order and reduced the fees. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
That's our show for this Monday. We'll leave you with the song Ping Dal by Vivian. We've been listening to Vivian with the song Ping Dal. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. We want to hear your comments about this show. Our email is southsudan@voanews.com. You can also find us on our Facebook page, South Sudan in Focus. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.